He pours a glass almost to the top, doesn't bother with ice, and hands it to me. "I know what you're here to ask. The answer is no. So let's just get that little bit of unpleasantness out of the way so we can enjoy the evening. Kane tells me you've come around on the Gibraltar dig. Says Craig gave you the nickel tour of our little project." He fixes me with a coy smile. "Now I'd like to hear your impression of it, as a professional miner. Will she hold until we can get through?" I start to speak several times. Wicked thoughts run through my head. "He brushed you aside like a door-to-door salesman. He's Imari, a snake as bad as Cain." I take a long pull of the drink and speak as evenly as I can. "I'd like to know why." "Let's not be uncivil, Mr. Pierce. She's in love with me." "I'm sure she is. War is an emotional time, but the war will end, and feelings will fade. The real world will set in. She'll come back to England, and she'll marry someone who can give her the life she truly wants, a life of civility and grace. A life you can't appreciate until you've seen the savagery of the rest of the world. That's what's in store for her. I've already made the arrangements." He crosses his legs and sips at his brandy. "You know, when Helena was a girl, she used to take in every flea-ridden, diseased, wounded, and otherwise half-dead animal that ever wandered onto the estate. She wouldn't relent until they'd either died or recovered. She has a good heart. But she grew up and lost all interest in rescuing animals. Everyone goes through phases like that, especially girls. Now, I'll hear your opinion on our tunnels in Gibraltar." "I don't give a damn about those tunnels or what's down there. It's a dangerous mine, and I won't work in it. What I will do is marry your daughter, with or without your permission. I'm not a wounded animal, and she's not a little girl anymore." I set the drink down on the glass table, almost breaking it, and sloshing brown liquid all over the place. "Thanks for the drink." I rise to leave, but he sets his own drink down and heads me off at the door. "Just a minute. You can't be serious. You've seen what's down there. You'd turn away from that?" I found something that interests me a great deal more than lost cities. "I've told you I've already made a match for Helena. It's settled. Let's put that aside. As for the dig, we can pay you." That's my role in this, incidentally. I manage the purse, the Imari treasury. Cain runs the expeditions, and a great deal more, as I'm sure you've gathered by now. Mallory's our master of spies. Don't underestimate Craig. He's quite good at it. So what will it take? We can double it. $2,000 per week. In a few months, you could set yourself up any way you like. I won't work that mine at any price." "Why not? The safety? You can fix it, I'm sure of it. The army men told us you were quite clever. The best, they said." I told her I wouldn't work in a mine. I made her a promise, and I won't make her a widow. "You assume you'll marry her. She won't marry without my permission." Lord Barton inhales and watches for my reaction, satisfied that he's cornered me. "You underestimate her. You overestimate her. But if that's your price, you can have it. And the $2,000 per week. But you agree right here and now that you'll work that dig to the finish. Once you do, I'll give my blessing without delay. You'd trade your approval for whatever's buried down there? Easily, I'm a practical man, and a responsible man. Maybe you will be one day. What's my daughter's future for the fate of the human race?" I almost laugh. But he fixes me with a stare that's dead serious. I rub my face and try to think. I hadn't expected the man to haggle, least of all over this business under Gibraltar. I know I'm making a mistake, but I don't see what option I have. "I'll have your permission now, not after the dig." Barton looks away. "How long to get into the structure?" "I don't know. Weeks? Months? Years?" "Months, I think. There's no way to know." "Fine. Fine, you have it. We'll announce it tonight. And if you don't keep up your end in Gibraltar, I'll make her a widow." Chapter 87. Associated Press Online Breaking News Bulletin. Clinics throughout U.S. and Western Europe report new flu outbreak. New York City, AP. Emergency rooms and urgent care clinics across the U.S. and Western Europe have reported a flood of new flu cases, sparking fears that it might be the beginning of an outbreak of a previously unidentified flu strain. Chapter 88. Kate leaned her head against the wooden wall of the alcove and stared at the sun, wishing she could stop it right where it was. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw David open his eyes and look up at her. She opened the journal and continued reading before he could say anything. December 20th, 1917. The Moroccan workers cower as the rock comes down around them. The space fills with smoke and we retreat back into the shaft. And then we wait and listen, ready to pile into the car that straddles the rails, ready to zoom out of the shaft at the first sign of trouble, fire or water in this case. The first cry of a canary breaks the silence, and one by one we all exhale and move back into the massive room to see how far the latest roll of the dice has gotten us. We're close, but not quite there.
"Told you we should have drilled it deeper," Rutger says.
I don't remember him saying anything. In fact, I'm pretty sure he sat indolently, not even inspecting the hole before we packed it with the chemical explosive. He walks to the excavation site for a better look, raking his hand on one of the canary cages as he passes by, sending the bird into a panic. "Don't touch the cages," I say.
"You'd let them choke to death on methane gas to give yourself a few minutes head start, but I can't even rattle them."
"Those birds could save every one of our lives. I won't have you torture them for your own enjoyment." Rutger unloads the rage meant for me on the Moroccan foreman. He shouts at the poor man in French, and the dozen workers begin clearing the rubble from the blast. It's been almost 4 months since I have toured the site, since I first set foot in this strange room. In the first few months of digging, it became clear that the part of the structure they had found was an access tunnel at the bottom of the structure. It led to a door that was sealed, with some sort of technology beyond anything we could ever hope to break through. And we tried everything: fire, ice, explosives, chemicals. The Berbers on the work crew even performed some strange tribal ritual, possibly for their own sake. But it soon became clear that we weren't getting through the door. Our theory is that it's some sort of drainage tunnel or emergency evacuation route, sealed for who knows how many thousands of years. After some debate, the Amari Council, that's Kane, Craig, and Lord Barton, my now father-in-law, decided we should move up the structure into the area that contains the methane pockets. That slowed us down, but in the last several weeks we've uncovered signs that we're reaching some sort of entrance. The smooth surface of the structure, some metal that's harder than steel and makes almost no noise when you strike it, has begun to slope. A week ago we found steps. The dust is clearing and I see more steps. Rutger shouts for the men to work faster, as if this thing is going anywhere. Beyond the dust behind me, I hear footfalls and see my assistant running.
"Mr. Pierce, your wife is at the office. She's looking for you."
"Rutger," I yell. He turns. "I'm taking the truck. Don't blast anything until I get back."
"The hell I won't. We're close, Pierce."
I grab the pack of blast caps and run to the car. "Drive me to the surface," I say to my assistant. Behind me, Rutger bellows out a tirade about my cowardice. At the surface, I change quickly and scrub my hands. Before I can leave for the office, the telephone at the warehouse rings, and the manager walks out.
"Sorry, Mr. Pierce, she's done and left."
"What did they tell her?"
"Sorry, sir, I don't know."
"Was she sick? Was she going to the hospital?" The man shrugs apologetically.
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't ask.
I'm out the door and in the car before he can finish. I rush to the hospital, but she's not there, and they haven't seen her. From the hospital, the switchboard operator connects me to the newly installed phone at our residence. It rings 10 times. The operator breaks on. I'm sorry, sir, but there's no answer. Let it ring. I'll wait. 5 more rings. 3 more. And our butler, Desmond, comes on.
Pierce residence. Desmond speaking.
Desmond? Is Mrs. Pierce there?
Yes, sir.
I wait. Well, put her on, then, I say, trying but failing to hide my nervousness.
Of course, sir, he says, embarrassed.
He's not used to the phone. It's probably why it took him so long to answer. 3 minutes pass, and Desmond comes back on the line.
She's in her room, sir.
Shall I have Myrtle go in and see about her?
No, I'll be there directly.
I hang up, run out of the hospital, and hop back in the car. I order my assistant to drive faster and faster. We zoom recklessly through the streets of Gibraltar, forcing several carriages off the street and scattering shoppers and tourists at each turn. When we arrive home, I jump out, race up the stairs, throw open the doors, and storm through the foyer. Pain punches at my leg with every step, and I'm sweating profusely, but I plow on, driven by fear. I climb the grand staircase to the second floor, make a beeline for our bedroom, and enter without knocking. Helena turns over, clearly surprised to see me, and surprised at the sight of me, sweat dripping from my forehead, the panting, the painful grimace.
Patrick?
Are you all right? I say as I sit on the bed with her and brush the thick blankets back. I run my hand over her swollen stomach. She sits up in the bed.
I could ask you the same thing. Of course I'm all right. Why wouldn't I be?
I thought you might have come because you... or there was a problem. I exhale and the worry flows from my body. I scold her with my eyes. The doctor said you should stay in bed. She slumps back into the pillows.
You try staying in bed for months on end.
I smile at her as she realizes what she said.
Sorry. But as I recall, you weren't all that good at it either.
No, you're right. I wasn't. I'm sorry I missed you. What is it?
What?
You came by the office?
Oh, yes. I wanted to see if you could slip out for lunch, but they told me you were already out.
Yes, problem down at the docks. It's the 100th time I've lied to Helena. It hasn't gotten any easier, but the alternative is a lot worse.
The perils of being a shipping magnate, she smiles. Well, maybe another day.
Maybe in a few weeks, when it will be 3 for lunch.
3 indeed, or maybe 4. I feel that big.
You don't look it.
You're a brilliant liar, she says.
Brilliant liar isn't the half of it. Our revelry is interrupted by the sound of knocking in the next room. I turn my head.
They're measuring the drawing room and the parlor below, Helena says.
We've already renovated for a nursery and enlarged 3 bedrooms for the children. I bought us a massive row house with a separate cottage for the house staff, and I can't imagine what else we might need now.
I thought we could build a dancing room with a parquet floor, like the one in my parents' house.
Every man has his limits. Helena can do whatever she wants to the house, that's not the issue. If we have a son? I ask.
Don't worry. She pats my hand. I won't subject your strong American son to the dull intricacies of English society dance. But we're having a girl.
I raise my eyebrows. You know this?
I have a feeling.
Then we'll need a dancing room, I say, smiling.
Speaking of dancing, an invitation came by messenger today. The Amari Annual Meeting and Christmas Ball. They're having it in Gibraltar this year. There's to be quite a celebration. I rang Mother. She and Father will be there. I'd like to go. I'll take it easy, I assure you.
Sure. It's a date. Chapter 89 Kate squinted, trying to read the journal. The sun was setting over the mountains, and dread was building in her stomach. She glanced over at David. His expression was almost blank, unreadable. maybe somber. As if reading her mind, Milo entered the large wood-floored room with a gas-burning lantern. Kate liked the smell. It somehow put her at ease. Milo set the lantern on a table by the bed, where the light would reach the journal, and said, "Good evening, Dr. Kate." Upon seeing that David was awake, he brightened. "And hello again, Mr. Re—"
"It's David Vale now. It's nice to see you again, Milo. You've gotten a lot taller."
"And that's not all, Mr. David. Milo has learned the ancient art of communication you know as English."
David laughed, "and learned it well. I wondered at the time if they would toss it out or actually give it to you, the Rosetta Stone."
"Ah, my mysterious benefactor finally reveals himself."
Milo bowed again.
"I thank you for the gift of your language. And now may I repay the gift, at least partially?"
He raised his eyebrows mysteriously.
"With the evening meal?"
"Please," Kate said, laughing. David gazed out the window. The last sliver of the sun slipped behind the mountain, like a pendulum disappearing in the side of a clock. "You should get your rest, Kate. It's a very long walk."
"I'll rest when we finish. I find reading relaxing."
She opened the book again. December 23rd, 1917. I strain to see as the dust clears. Then I squint, not believing my eyes. We've uncovered more stairs, but there's something else, expanding to the right of the stairs, an opening like a gash in the metal.
"We're in!" Rutger yells, and rushes forward into the darkness and floating dust.
I grab for him, but he breaks my grasp. My leg has gotten some better, to the point where I only take one pain pill, sometimes two, each day, but I'll never catch him.
"You want us to go after him?"
the Moroccan foreman asks.
"No,"
I say. I wouldn't sacrifice one of them to save Rutger. "Hand me one of the birds." I take the canary cage, switch my headlamp on, and wade into the dark opening. The jagged portal is clearly the result of a blast or a rip, but we didn't make it. We merely found it. The metal walls are almost 5 feet thick. As I cross into this structure, the Amari have been digging and diving for going on almost 60 years. I'm finally overcome by awe. The first area is a corridor, 10 feet wide by 30 feet long. It opens to a circular room with wonders I can't begin to describe. The first thing that catches my eye is an indentation in the wall with 4 large tubes, like massive oblong capsules or elongated mason jars, standing on their ends, running from the floor to the ceiling. They're empty except for a faint white light and fog that floats at the bottom. Farther over, there are 2 more tubes. One is damaged, I think. The glass is cracked, and there's no fog. But the tube beside it, there's something in it. Rutger sees it just as I do, and he's at the tube, which seems to sense our presence. The fog clears as we approach, like a curtain rolling back to reveal its secret. It's a man. No, an ape. Or something in between. Rutger looks back at me. For the first time, with an expression other than arrogance or contempt, he's confused. Maybe scared. I certainly am. I put my hand on his shoulder and resume scanning the room. "Don't touch anything, Rutger." Chapter 90. December 24th, 1917. Helena glows in the dress. The tailor spent a week taking it out and took me for a small fortune, but it was worth the wait, and every last shilling I paid him. She's radiant. We dance, both ignoring her promise to take it easy. I can't say no to her. Mostly I stand stationary, but the pain is manageable, and for perhaps once in our lives we are well matched on the dance floor. The music slows. She rests her head on my shoulder, and I forget about the ape man and the tube. The world feels normal again, for the first time since that tunnel exploded on the Western Front. Then, like the fog in the tube, it all goes away. The music stops and Lord Barton is speaking,
raising a glass. He's toasting me. Amari's new head of shipping, his daughter's husband, and a war hero. Heads nod around the room. There's some joke about a modern-day Lazarus man back from the dead. Laughter. I smile. Helena hugs me closer. Barton's finally finished, and around the room, revelers are downing champagne and nodding at me. I make a silly little bow and escort Helena back to our table. At that moment, for some reason I can't understand, all I can think about is the last time I saw my father. The day before I shipped off to the war. He got drunk as a sailor that night and lost control. The first, last, and only time I ever saw him lose control. He told me about his childhood that night. And I understood him, or so I thought. How much can you ever really understand any man? We lived in a modest home in downtown Charleston, West Virginia, alongside the homes of people who worked for my father. His peers, the other business owners, merchants, and bankers, lived across town, and my father liked it that way. He paced the living room, spitting as he spoke. I sat there in my pristine tan U.S. Army uniform, the single brass bar of a second lieutenant's rank hanging on my collar.
"You look as foolish as another man I knew who joined an American army." He was almost giddy as he ran back to the cabin. He waved the letter in the air like the king himself had written it. He read it to us, but I didn't understand it all then. We were moving down to America, a place called Virginia. The war between the states had broken out about 2 years earlier. Can't remember exactly when, but it was getting pretty bloody by this point. And both sides needed more men, fresh bodies for the grinder. But if you were rich enough, you didn't have to go. You just had to send a substitute. Some rich southern planter had hired your grandfather as his substitute. A substitute. The idea of hiring another man to die in the war in your place just because you have the money. When they start the conscriptions this go-round, I'll see to it in the Senate that no man can send a replacement. They won't need conscripts. Brave men are joining by the thousands. He laughed and poured another drink. Brave men by the thousands. Fools by the train car load, joining because they think there's glory in it. Maybe fame and adventure. They don't know the cost of war. The price you pay. He shook his head and took another long pull, almost emptying the glass. Word will get around soon, and then they'll have to draft, just like the states did during the Civil War. They didn't at first. This was years after the war started, when people got a taste of it. That's when they began the conscriptions, and rich men started writing to poor men like my father. But the post runs slow in the Canadian frontier, especially if you're a logger living way out of town. By the time we got down to Virginia, this planter had already hired another substitute. Said he hadn't heard from your grandfather, was scared he'd have to show up himself, heaven forbid. But we were in Virginia, and he was hell-bent on fighting for a fortune. Up to $1,000, that's what the substitutes were paid, and it was a fortune, if you could collect it. Well, he didn't. He found another planter who was up against it, and he wore that wretched gray uniform and died in it. When the South lost, society crumbled, and the huge tract of land promised to your grandfather as payment was bought by some northern carpetbagger on the steps of the county courthouse for pennies on the dollar. He finally sat down, his glass empty. But that was the least of the horror of Reconstruction. I watched my only brother die of typhoid while the occupying Union soldiers ate us out of house and home. What home there was, a small run-down shack on the plantation. The new owner kicked us out, but my mother made a deal. She'd work the fields if we could stay. And she did. Work those fields to death. I was 12 when I walked off the plantation and hitched my way to West Virginia. Work in the mines was hard to get. But they needed boys, the smaller the better, to crawl through the narrow spaces. So that's the cost of war. Now you know. At least you don't have a family. But that's what you have to look forward to. Death and misery. If you've ever wondered why I was so hard on you, so frugal, so demanding, there it is. Life is hard. For everyone.
but it's hell on earth if you're foolish or weak. You're neither. I've seen to it. And this is how you repay me. This is a different war. It's always the same war. Only the names of the dead change. It's always about one thing. Which group of rich men get to divvy up the spoils? They call it the Great War. Clever marketing. It's a European civil war. The only question is which kings and queens will divvy up the continent when it's all over. America's got no business over there. That's why I voted against it. The Europeans had the good sense to stay the hell out of our civil war. You'd think we might do the same. Whole affair is practically a family feud between the royal families. They're all cousins. And they're our cousins. Our mother country's back is against the wall. They would come to our aid if we were facing annihilation. We don't owe them a thing. America is ours. We've paid for this land with our blood, sweat, and tears, the only currency that's ever mattered. They need miners, desperately. Tunnel warfare could end the war early. You'd have me stay home? I can save lives. You can't save lives. He looked disgusted. You haven't understood a word I've said, have you? Get out of here. And even if you do make it back from the war, don't come back here. But do me one favor, for all I've given you. When you figure out that you're fighting some other man's war, walk away. And don't start a family until you take that uniform off. Don't be as cruel and greedy as he was. He walked through the devastation of the North to reach that plantation in Virginia. He knew what he was getting into, and he charged on. When you see war, you'll know. Make better choices than the one you made today. He walked out of the room, and I never saw him again. I'm so lost in the memory, I barely noticed the throngs of people that file past us, introducing themselves and touching Helena's stomach. We sit there like a royal couple at some state function. There are dozens of scientists, in town, no doubt, to study the room we recently uncovered. I meet the heads of Amari divisions overseas. The organization is massive. Conrad Kane marches over. His legs and arms are rigid, his back straight and unbending, as if he were being probed with some unseen instrument. He introduces the woman at his side, his wife. Her smile is warm, and she speaks kindly, which catches me off guard. I'm a little embarrassed at my harsh demeanor. A young boy runs from behind her, she must have been holding him, and jumps into Helena's lap, crushing her stomach. I grab him by the arm, jerking him off of her and back onto the ground. My face is filled with rage, and the boy looks as though he will cry. Conrad locks eyes with me, but the boy's mother has her arms around him, admonishing, "Be careful, Dieter, Helena is pregnant." Helena straightens in the chair and reaches for the boy. "It's okay. Give me your hand, Dieter." She takes the boy's arm and pulls him to her, placing the hand on her stomach. "You feel that?" The boy looks up at Helena and nods. Helena smiles at him. "I remember when you were inside your mama's stomach. I remember the day you were born." Lord Barton steps between Conrad and me. "It's time." He looks at the woman and the child palming Helena's swollen belly. "Excuse us, ladies." Barton leads us through the hall to a large conference room. The other apostles of the apocalypse are here waiting on us. Rutger, Mallory Craig, and a cadre of other men, mostly scientists and researchers. The introductions are hasty. These men are clearly less starstruck with me. There's another quick round of congratulations and hyperbole, like, "We've cured the plague." Then they get down to business.
"When will we get through to the top of the stairwell?" Conrad asks.
I know what I want to say, but curiosity gets the better of me.
"What are the devices in the chamber we found?"
One of the scientists speaks.
"We're still studying them, some sort of suspension chamber."
I had assumed as much, but it sounds less crazy when a scientist says it. "The room is some sort of laboratory?" The scientists nod.
"Yes, we believe the building is a science building, possibly one giant lab."
"What if it's not a building?"
The scientist looks confused. "What else could it be?"
"A ship," I say. Barton lets out a laugh and speaks jovially.
That's rich, Patty.
Why don't you focus on the digging and leave the science to these men? He nods appreciatively at the scientists.
I assure you they're better at it than you are. Now, Rutger has told us you're worried about water and gas above the stairs. What's your plan?
I press on. The walls, inside the structure, they look like bulkheads in a ship. The lead scientist hesitates, then says,
Yes, they do. But they're too thick, almost 5 feet. No ship would need walls that thick, and it wouldn't float. It's also too large to be a ship. It's a city, we're fairly certain of that. And there are the stairs. Stairs on a ship would be very curious.
Barton holds up his hand.
We'll sort out all these mysteries when we're inside. Can you give us an estimate, Pierce?
I can't.
Why not?
My mind drifts back to that night in West Virginia for a brief moment. Then I'm back in the room, staring at the Amari Council and the scientists. Because I'm done digging. Find someone else, I say.
Now, look here, my boy. This isn't some social club, some frivolous thing you join and then quit when the dues become too burdensome. You'll finish the job and make good on your promise, Lord Barton says. I said I'd get you through, and I have. This isn't my war to fight. I have a family now.
Barton rises to shout, but Kane catches his arm and speaks for the first time.
War. An interesting choice of words. Tell me, Mr. Pierce, what do you think is in that last tube?
I don't know, and I don't care.
You should, Kane says. It's not human, and it doesn't match any bonds we've ever found.
He waits for my reaction.
Let me connect the dots for you, as you seem either unable or remiss to do so. Someone built this structure, the most advanced piece of technology on the planet, and they built it thousands of years ago, maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago. And that frozen ape man has been in there for who knows how many thousands of years.
Waiting. Waiting for what?
We don't know. But I can assure you that when he and the rest of the people who built that structure wake up, the human race is finished on this planet.
So you say this isn't your war?
But it is. You can't outrun this war. Can't simply abstain or move away, because this enemy will chase us to the far corners of the world and exterminate us.
You assume they're hostile, because you're hostile. Extermination and war and power dominate your thoughts, and you assume the same for them.
The only thing we know for sure is this. That thing is some form of man. My assumptions are valid and practical. Killing them ensures our survival. Making friends does not.
I consider what he said, and I'm ashamed to admit I think it makes sense.
Kane seems to sense my wavering. You know it's true, Pierce. They're smarter than we are, infinitely smarter. If they do let us live, even some of us, we'll be nothing more than pets to them. Maybe they'll breed us to be docile and friendly, feeding us like curious wolves by their proverbial campfire, weeding out the aggressive ones. The same way we made dogs so many thousands of years ago. They'll make us so civilized we can't imagine fighting back, can't hunt, and can't feed ourselves. Maybe it's already happening, and we don't even know it. Or maybe they won't find us that cute at all. We could become their slaves. You're familiar with this concept, I believe? A group of brutal yet intelligent humans with advanced technology subjugating a less advanced group. But this time it will be for the rest of eternity. We would never advance or evolve further. Think of it. But we can prevent that fate. It seems harsh to go in and murder them in their sleep, but think of the alternative. We will be celebrated as heroes when history learns the truth. We are the liberators of the human race, the emancipators. No. Whatever happens from here happens without me.
I can't get the image of Helena's face out of my mind, the thought of holding our child, of growing old by some lake, of teaching our grandchildren to fish when they're on break from school. I can't make a difference in the Amari plan. They'll find another miner,
Maybe it will set them back a few months, but whatever is down there will wait. I stand and stare at Kane and Barton for a long moment. Gentlemen, you'll have to excuse me. My wife is pregnant, and I should be getting her home. I focus on Barton. We're expecting our first child. I wish you the best on the project. As you know, I was a soldier, and soldiers can keep secrets almost as well as they can fight. But I hope my fighting days are behind me. David sat up. I know what they're doing.
Who?
The Amari. Toba Protocol. It makes sense now. They're building an army. I would bet on it. They think humanity is facing an advanced enemy. Toba Protocol, reducing the total population, causing a genetic bottleneck, and a second great leap forward. They're doing it to create a race of super soldiers, advanced humans who can battle whoever built that thing in Gibraltar.
Maybe. There's something else. In China, there was a device. I think it has something to do with this, Kate said.
She told David about her experience in China, about the bell-shaped object that massacred the subjects before melting and then exploding. When she finished, David nodded.
I think I know what it is.
You do?
Yeah, maybe.
Keep reading.
Chapter 91. January 18th, 1917. When the butler burst through the doors to my study, my first thought is Helena. Her water's broken, or she's fallen, or...
Mr. Pierce, your office is on the line. They say it's important, urgent, regarding the docks inside the warehouse.
I walk down to the butler's office and pick up the phone. Mallory Craig begins speaking before I say a word.
Patrick, there's been an accident.
Rutger wouldn't let them call you, but I thought you should know.
He pressed too hard, went too far too fast. Some of the Moroccan workers are trapped. They say, I'm up and out the door before he finishes.
I drive myself to the warehouse and hop in the electric car alongside my former assistant. We drive as recklessly as Rutger did the first day he showed me the tunnel. The fool has done it. He pressed on and caused a cave-in. I dread seeing it, but urge my assistant to drive faster anyway. As the tunnel opens on the massive stone room I've worked in for the last 4 months, I notice that the electric lights are off. But the room isn't dark. A dozen beams of light crisscross the room, the headlamps of the miners' helmets. A man, the foreman, grabs me by the arm.
Rutger is on the telly for you, Mr. Pierce.
On the phone, I say as I traipse across the dark space. I stop. There's water on my forehead. Was it sweat?
No, there's another one. A drop of water from the ceiling. It's sweating.
I grab the phone.
Rutger, they said there's been an accident. Where are you?
Somewhere safe.
Don't play games. Where's the accident?
Oh, you're in the right place.
Rutger's tone is playful and confident, satisfied. I glance around the room. The miners are milling about, confused. Why aren't the lights on? I set the phone down and walk over to the electric line. It's connected to something, a new cable. I shine my light on it, following it around the room. It runs up the wall, to the ceiling, and then over to the stairs to...
Get out! I yell.
I struggle over the uneven ground to the back of the room and try to corral the workers, but they simply stumble over each other in the choppy sea of light and shadows. Overhead, a blast rings out in the space and rocks fall. Dust envelops the room, and it's just like the tunnels at the Western Front. I can't save them. I can't even see them. I stagger back into the tunnel, the corridor to the lab. The dust follows me and I hear Rock close the entrance off. The screams fade away, just like that, like a door closing. And I'm in total darkness except for the soft glow of the white light and fog in the tubes. I don't know how much time has passed, but I'm hungry, very hungry. My headlamp has long since burned out, and I sit in the still darkness, leaning against the wall, thinking, Helena has to be mad with worry. Will she finally find out my secret? Will she forgive me? It all presupposes I get out of here. On the other side of the rock I hear footsteps and voices. Both are muffled, but there's just enough space between the rocks to hear them.
Hey!
I have to choose my words carefully. Get on the telly and ring Lord Barton. Tell him Patrick Pierce is trapped in the tunnels. I hear laughter. Rutger.
You're a survivor, Pierce.
I'll give you that. And you're a brilliant miner, but when it comes to people, you're about as thick as the walls to the structure. Barton will have your head for killing me.
Barton? Who do you think gave the order? You think I could just knock you off? If so, I would have gotten rid of you a long time ago. No, Barton and Fata planned for Helena and I to marry before we were even born. But she wasn't keen on the idea. May have been why she hopped on the first train to Gibraltar when the war broke out. But we can't escape fate. The dig brought me here, too, and life was about to get back on track until your gimp ass came along and the methane leaks killed my crews. Barton made a deal, but he promised Papa it could be undone. The pregnancy was about the last straw, but don't worry, I'll take care of it. So many children die right after birth, from all sorts of mysterious diseases. Don't worry, I'll be there to comfort her. We've known each other for ages.
I'm going to get out of here, Rutger. And when I do, I'm going to kill you. You understand me?
Keep quiet, Patty boy.
Men are working here. He moves away from the rock-covered entrance to the corridor. He shouts in German, and I hear footfalls all around the room. For the next few hours, I don't know how long, I ransack the mysterious lab. There's nothing I can use. All the doors are sealed. This will be my tomb. There has to be some way out. Finally, I sit and stare at the walls, waiting, watching them shimmer like glass, almost reflecting the light from the tubes, but not quite. It's a dull recreation, the kind of reflection iron makes. Above me, I occasionally hear drilling and pickaxes striking rocks. They're trying to finish the job. They must be close to the top of the stairs. Suddenly, the noise stops, and I hear yelling.
Wasser! Wasser!
Water. They must have hit. Then loud booms. The unmistakable sound of falling rock. I run to the entrance and listen. Screams, rushing water, something else, a drum beat, or a pulsing vibration, getting louder every second. More screams, men running. The car cranks and roars away. I strain, but I can't hear anything else. In the absence of sound, I realize I'm standing in 2 feet of water. It's seeping in through the loosely stacked rock, and quickly. I slosh back into the corridor. There must be a door to the lab. I bang around on the walls, but nothing works. The water is in the lab now. It will overtake me in minutes. The tube. It's open. One of the four. What choice do I have? I wade through the water and collapse into it. The fog surrounds me, and the door closes. Chapter 92. Snow Camp Alpha, Drill Site Number 6, East Antarctica. Robert Hunt sat in his housing pod, warming his hands around a fresh cup of burned coffee. After the near disaster at the last drill site, he was glad they had reached 7,000 feet without so much as a hiccup. No pockets of air, water, or sediment. Maybe it would be like the first four sites, nothing but ice. He sipped the coffee and considered what might account for the drilling difference at the last site. Beyond the pod's door, a high-pitched sound erupted, the unmistakable whirl of a drill under low to no tension. He ran out of the pod, made eye contact with the operator, and jerked his hand across his neck. The man lunged and hit the kill switch. The man was learning, thank God. Robert jogged to the platform. The technician turned to him and said, "Should we reverse out?" "No." Robert checked the depth. It read 7,309 feet. "Lower the drill. Let's see how deep the pocket is." The man lowered the drill, and Robert watched the depth reading climb. 7,400, 7,450, 7,500.
7,550, 7,600. It stopped at 7,624. Robert's mind raced with possibilities. A cavern a mile and a half below the ice? It could be something on the surface of the ground, but what? The cavern, or pocket, whatever it was 300 feet tall. Its ceiling was almost a football field above its floor. The laws of gravity just didn't work that way. What had the strength to hold up 1.5 miles of ice? The technician turned to Robert and asked, "Start drilling again?" Robert, still deep in thought, waved a hand over the controls and mumbled,
No, don't do anything. I need to call this in."
Back at his pod, he activated the radio.
"Bounty, there's the Snow King. I have a status update."
A few seconds passed before the radio crackled and the reply came.
"Go ahead, Snow King." "We hit a pocket at depth 7309, repeat, 7309 feet. Pocket ends at 7624, repeat, 7624 feet. Request instruction. Over."
"Stand by, Snow King." Robert began preparing another pot of coffee. His team would probably need some.
"Snow King, what is the status of the drill? Over." "Bounty, drill is still in the hole at max depth. Over."
"Understood, Snow King." "Instructions are as follows. Extract drill, lock down sight, and proceed to location 7. Stand by for GPS coordinates." As before, he wrote down the coordinates and endured the redundant warning about local contact. He folded the paper with the GPS coordinates and placed it in his pocket, then stood, grabbed the 2 cups of fresh coffee and headed out of the pod. They reversed the drill out and prepared the site with ease. The 3 men worked efficiently, almost mechanically, and silently. From the air, they might have looked like 3 Eskimo versions of 10 soldiers racing around on a track, performing some sort of ballet in the snow as they danced around each other, lifting and stacking crates, opening large white umbrellas to cover small items, and anchoring white metal poles for the massive canopy that covered the drill site. When they finished, the 2 techs mounted their snowmobiles and waited for Robert to lead them. He rested his arm on the plastic chest that contained the cameras and looked up at the site. $2 million was a lot of money. The 2 men glanced back at him. They had started their snowmobiles, but 1 tech turned his off. Robert brushed some snow off the chest and opened 1 latch. The sound of the radio startled him.
"Snow King, Bounty, situation report."
Robert clicked the button on the radio and hesitated for a second.
"Bounty, this is Snow King." He glanced at the men. "We're evacuating the site now."
He snapped the latch shut and stood for a moment. The whole thing felt wrong. The radio silence, all the secrecy. But what did he know? He was paid to drill. Maybe they weren't doing anything wrong. Maybe they just didn't want the press broadcasting their business to the world. Nothing wrong with that. Getting fired for being curious would be a hell of a thing. But he wasn't quite that stupid. He imagined himself telling his son, "I'm sorry, college will have to wait. I just can't afford it right now. Yes, I could have, but I couldn't stand the mystery." Then again, if there was something going on, and he was part of it. "Son, you can't go to college because your dad is an international criminal. And P.S., he was too dumb to even know it." Robert wasn't that stupid either. The other man stopped the engine on his snowmobile. Both techs stared at him. Robert walked over to the excess cover supplies. He picked up a closed 8-foot-long white umbrella and tied it to his snowmobile. He cranked the machine and drove toward the next location. The 2 men followed close behind. 30 minutes into their trek, Robert spotted a large rock overhang rising out of the snow. It wasn't deep enough to be a cave, but the indentation cut 20 or 30 feet into the mountain and cast a long shadow. He adjusted their vector to pass close by the overhang, and at the last second, he veered off into the darkness of the shadow. Despite riding close behind him, the 2 men matched his course quickly and parked their snowmobiles beside his. Robert was still seated. Neither man dismounted.
"I forgot something at the site. I'll be back. Shouldn't take long. Wait here, and don't leave the ravine."
Neither man said anything. Robert could feel his nervousness growing. He was a terrible liar. He continued, hoping to legitimize his orders. "They've asked us to minimize our visibility from the air." He opened the white umbrella and planted it beside him, anchoring it against the snowmobile as if he were a medieval knight locking a lance next to him and readying his horse for the charge. He backed his snowmobile out and returned the way they had come, back to the site. Chapter 93. Kate yawned and turned the page. The room was cold, and she and David were wrapped in a thick blanket now. "Finish it on the walk out," David said through sleepy eyes. "You'll need to stop a lot." "Okay, I just want to get to a good stopping place," she said. "You stayed up reading as a kid, didn't you?" "About every night." "You?"
"Video games."
"Figures."
"Sometimes Legos."
David yawned again. "How many pages left?" Kate flipped through the journal. "Not many. Actually, just a few more. I can stay awake if you can."
"Like I said, I've slept enough, and I don't have a hike tomorrow."
I awake to the soft hiss of air flowing into the tube. At first, the air feels heavy, like water in my lungs. But after a few deep gulps of the damp, cold air, my breathing normalizes, and I take stock of my situation. The room is still dark, but there's a faint shaft of light drifting into the lab from the corridor. I rise from the tube and walk toward the corridor, surveying the room as I go. None of the other tubes are occupied, save for the ape man, who apparently slept through the flood without incident. I wonder how many he slept through. There's still about a foot of water in the corridor, enough to notice, but not enough to slow me down. I slosh toward the jagged opening. The rocks that locked me inside are almost completely gone, washed away, no doubt. A soft amber glow from above drapes the remaining rocks, which I push aside as I step out into the room. The source of the strange light hangs 30 feet above me, at the top of the stairs. It looks like a bell, or a large pawn, with windows in the top. I eye it, trying to figure out what it is. It seems to stare back at me, the lights pulsing slowly, like a lion's heart beating after it's devoured a victim on the Serengeti. I stand still, wondering if it will attack me, but nothing happens. My eyes are adjusting, and with every passing second, more of the room comes into focus. The floor is a nightmarish soup of water, ashes, dirt, and blood. At the very bottom, I see the bodies of the Moroccan miners, crushed under the rubble. Above them, Europeans lie prostrate, ripped to shreds, some burned, all mutilated by a weapon I can't imagine. It's not an explosion or a gun or a knife, and they didn't die recently. The wounds look old. How long have I been down here? I search the bodies, hoping to see one in particular, but Rutger isn't here. I rub my face. I've got to focus. Got to get home. Helena. The electric car is gone. I'm weak, tired, and hungry, and at that moment I'm not sure I will ever see daylight again, but I put one foot in front of the other and start the arduous trek out of the mine. I pump my legs as hard as they'll go and brace for the pain, but it never touches me. I'm driven to get out of this place by a strength and fire I didn't know I possessed. The mine flies by in a flash, and I see the light as I hike out of the last turn of the spiral. They've covered the entrance to the tunnel with a white tent, or a plastic sheet of some type. I brush the flap aside, and I'm surrounded by soldiers in gas masks and strange plastic suits. I wrestle free, but they tackle me and hold me to the floor. From the ground, I see a tall soldier stride over. Even through the bulky suit, I know who it is. Conrad Kane. One of my captors looks up at him and speaks through the mask in a muffled voice.
"He just walked out, sir."
"Bring him," Kane says in a deep, disembodied voice. The men drag me deeper into the warehouse to a series of 6 white tents that remind me of a field hospital. The first tent has row after row of cots, all covered in white sheets. I hear screams in the next tent. Helena. I struggle against the men at my sides, but I'm too weak. From lack of food, from the walk out, and from whatever the tube did to me. They hold me tight, but I continue to fight. I can hear her clearly now, at the end of the tent, behind a white curtain. I lunge for her, but the soldiers jerk me back, walking me down the row so I get a good look at the people lying dead on the skinny cots. Horror spreads over me. Lord Barton and Lady Barton are here. Rutger, Kane's wife, all dead. And there are others, people I don't recognize, scientists, soldiers, nurses. We pass a bed with a boy, Kane's son. Dietrich? Dieter? I can hear the doctors talking to Helena, and as we move past the edge of the curtain, I see them swarming around her, injecting her with something, and holding her down. The men hold me as I struggle. Kane turns to me. I want you to see this, Pierce. You can watch her die like I watched Rutger and Marie die. They drag me closer. What happened? I say. You unleashed hell, Pierce. You could have helped us. Whatever is down there killed Rutger and half his men. The ones who managed to make it back to the surface were diseased. A plague beyond anything we could imagine. It devastated Gibraltar and is moving through Spain. He pulls the white curtain back farther, revealing the entire scene. Helena tossing in a bed surrounded by three men and two women working feverishly. I push the guards off me, and Kane holds a hand up to stop them from chasing me. I run to her, brush her hair back and kiss her cheek, then her mouth. She's burning up. Feeling her boiling skin terrifies me, and she must see it. She reaches out and caresses my face.
It's okay, Patrick. It's only the flu. Spanish flu. It will pass.
I look up at the doctor. His eyes dart to the ground. A tear wells in my eye and rolls slowly onto my cheek. Helena brushes it away.
I'm so glad you're safe. They told me you were killed in a mining accident, trying to save the Moroccans who worked for you.
She holds my face in her hand.
So brave.
She jerks a hand to her mouth, trying to suppress the cough that shakes her whole body and the rolling hospital bed. She holds her swollen belly with the other hand, trying to keep herself from hitting the rails at the side of the bed. The cough continues for what feels like eternity. It sounds like her lungs are tearing apart. I hold her shoulders down. Helena.
I forgive you for not telling me. I know you did it for me.
Don't forgive me. Please, don't. Another round of coughing racks her, and the doctors push me out of the way. They give her oxygen, but it doesn't seem to help. I watch, and I cry, and Kane watches me. She kicks and fights, and when her body goes limp, I turn to Kane, and my voice is flat, lifeless, almost like his voice that comes from the mask. Then and there, in that makeshift Imari hospital, I make a deal with the devil. The tears rolled down Kate's face. She closed her eyes, and she wasn't in the bed with David in Tibet. She was back in San Francisco, on a cold night 5 years ago, on a gurney. They were rushing her out of the ambulance and into the hospital. Doctors and nurses shouted around her, and she was yelling at them, but they wouldn't listen to her. She grabbed the doctor's arm.
Save the baby. If it's between me and the baby, save.
The doctor pulled away from her and shouted at the burly man pushing the gurney.
OR2, stat.
They wheeled her faster. The mask was over her mouth, and she fought to stay awake. She awoke to a large, empty hospital room. She hurt all over. There were several tubes running from her arm. She reached quickly from her stomach, but she knew before her hands made contact. She pulled the gown back to reveal the long, ugly scar. She buried her head in her hands and cried, for how long she didn't know.
Dr. Warner?
Kate looked up, startled, hopeful. A shy nurse stood before her.
My baby?
Kate said, her voice cracking. The nurse's eyes drifted down, focusing on her feet. Kate crumbled back in the bed. The tears came in sheets now.
Ma'am, We weren't sure. There's no in case of emergency on file. Should... Is there...